now on ABC Radio National, it's time for Counterpoint, an hour of opinion and discussion with Paul Comrie-Thompson and Michael Duffy.
Hello and welcome to the program. In a moment, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has had its reputation somewhat tarnished of late. In an attempt to address a series of problems faced by the organisation, the UN commissioned an external review of procedures and processes. So what was the outcome? Ainsley Kellow joins us shortly to explain what this review means for the body that has done so much to convince governments and the general public that a changing climate heralds the coming of a permanently damaged world.
And then a look at one of the best books I've read in a long time. It's called Wrong. Its author, David Friedman, argues that experts get it wrong time and time again. He tells us why this is so later today on Counterpoint.
Before we hear about experts being in error, Jeremy Thacker from the University of Chicago joins us to argue for some radical self-criticism by certain right-wing thinkers. He says if they want to be consistent, conservatives ought really to be anti-capitalist because the essence of conservatism is the passionate affirmation of the value of existing institutions. So, stirring the possum even further, he says conservatives should read Karl Marx.
But first to climate matters. Joining us now is Ainsley Kellow, Professor of Government at the University of Tasmania. Ainsley was an expert reviewer for the 2007 IPCC Fourth Assessment Report. He's the author of Science and Public Policy, The Virtuous Corruption of Virtual Environmental Science. Now, there have been a number of inquiries, reports, and indeed concerns expressed into the current state of climate science. Many of these arose from the scandals known as Climategate. Well, this month saw the release of a review of the IPCC's own procedures, and it was conducted by something called the Inter-Academy Council. That's an association of national science academies. Here now is Ainsley Kellow's assessment.
The review was really set up because of some problems with the IPCC process. Now, I think it's fair to say that those of us who've looked at this critically over a decade or more are unhappy with the process anyway. There are certain inherent biases in it. I mean, the assumption that you need a scientific consensus on the issue presupposes that you need political action, because the argument is you won't get political action without a consensus emerging. So not content with one emerging on the strength of the science, a political process was established to produce a consensus. So it kind of prejudges the issue. Those who've been able to participate most in this have tended to be those whose positions are in climate institutes, who have a fairly clear interest in the acceptance of the nature of the problem continuing, because their livelihoods depend upon it. Those who are able to go away to the various drafting conferences and so on have tended to be those in those kind of research-only institutes. If you've got a teaching, heavy teaching commitments, you can't get there. And I know this only too well. I was invited into the second assessment report back in the 90s, but you know, you can't turn around and tell your students, well, I'm sorry, I'm heading off for 2 weeks to sit in a room and discuss the impacts of climate change. So there are those kinds of biases there, but there were some specific problems, of course, with the fourth assessment report, what became known as Himalaya Gate, where a projection, and they should always be regarded only as projections, that the entire Himalayan glaciers were going to disappear by 2035, drew attention to some quality problems, because anyone who thinks about the physics of that knows that that's damn near impossible. But in fact, the source it drew upon, which turned out to be grey literature, not solid scientific literature, had said 2350. So either someone had a silly transposition somewhere in the production of the report. But even so, the fact that it passed the review by the IPCC and made it into the final report was an appalling lack of attention to quality on the part of the committee. Similar one, again, based on kind of activist literature about supposed rates of deforestation in the Amazon. Another one on a very weak foundation about supposed declines in agricultural productivity in Africa by 2020. So it turned out that there were some very serious questions, leaving aside the quality of the science underlying that, about the process that the IPCC was following and the quality of some of the literature that was finding its way in to the report, and the breaking of its own standards of requiring the literature to be peer-reviewed rather than so-called grey literature.
Yeah. There were concerns also with the way the IPCC responded when these errors were pointed out, weren't there?
Oh, yes. I mean, Rajendra Pachauri, the leader of the IPCC, attacked the person in India who drew this first point of this out as you know, practicing voodoo science. So there was the usual kind of ad hominem attack. And, of course, there's this tendency to dismiss any critic as being a denier, which has politicised and made difficult the conduct of decent critical scientific discussion, critical policy discussion, that you either accept the prevailing view of things or you get labelled a denier. Our own former Prime Minister and our former Climate Change Minister used to use the word, and I've now got a rule of thumb that anyone who uses the word denier should immediately not be listened to, because they're not talking about science. They're simply trying to use political rhetoric to marginalise dissenting voices, and that's not what science is about. It's inherently anti-science.
Yeah. So the United Nations decided to review the IPCC. They selected the Inter-Academy Council, which, of course, is an organisation of science academies from around the world. Can we just run through the report briefly, and then I might ask you at the end if you're, you know, satisfied with the range of it. The first one they looked at was governance and management, wasn't it? What did they decide there?
Well, their main concerns, I think, were, I suppose, with the lack of openness overall, and also the kind of domination of the process from year to year by one person. And they, for example, thought that and made a recommendation to the effect that there should be an elected executive director to lead the secretariat to handle day-to-day operations. And that the term of this person should be limited to the time frame of one assessment. In other words, they don't think Pachauri should do the next one. At the moment, he's in place to perform that. But they also thought there should be an executive committee to act on the behalf of the committee between sessions, and so on. So there was a number of concerns about the way in which it was being governed.
Mm. And are you happy with the recommendations there?
I think so. You know, I tend to follow critics like, David Henderson, who thinks in an area like this particularly, you should almost institutionalise dissent and have a kind of B team, you know, have impanel a group of people who are sceptically minded, who want to take issue with this science. And from that process, of course, policymakers would end up with a less clear message, but probably a more accurate message.
What about the actual review process? What did the committee have to say about that?
The strongest criticisms, and the ones that I would share from my experience, had to do with the fact that the lead authors were basically the arbiters of any changes that should be made to their work. Now, we can add to that, of course, the additional problem that many of these lead authors were reviewing research that they had conducted. And the problem with Michael Mann and his hockey stick ultimately was that he was a lead author of the chapter that gave such great prominence to his own work in the third assessment report. People have pointed out recently that in working group two, there's a whole lot of stuff on health impacts which appears to closely resemble an earlier book by one of the lead authors of the chapter. So again, they've kind of sat in judgment on their own previous work and decided that it is good. Now that's a process which is entirely problematic, of course. So it comes down to the ability of review editors in that process, and they've recommended that review editors should be encouraged to fully exercise their authority to ensure reviewers' comments are adequately considered by the authors and that genuine controversies are adequately reflected in the report. Mm. Now, I must say, in Chapter 19 of the Fourth Assessment Report, Working Group 2, that I acted as a reviewer on, we had an excellent review editor in John Zillman, an Australian former head of the Bureau of Meteorology, former president of the World Meteorological Organization, who was very diligent in taking up the points that I and others made and pressing the lead authors to make necessary adjustments. But if you look at the process, there were lots of review editors who were not as diligent as John Zillman was.
Mm. Okay, and so we're going to have to skip ahead a bit because we've got a risk of running out of time. But
sure.
What about this issue of characterising and communicating uncertainty? What did the review find about that?
They thought that, the committee was tending to put kind of probability statements on things about which we don't know enough to make such probability statements.
That's a pretty serious criticism given the nature of the subject, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it goes ultimately to the kind of policy that we should be considering because, for example, I think there's so much uncertainty in the forward projections of climate change that a cap-and-trade system is inappropriate because to have a decent cap-and-trade approach, you have to know what size the cap should be. Too high a cap, you get no effect. Too low a cap, the economic costs of mitigating are too high. And that's essentially because that reflects the uncertainty in the science. If you admit to the great levels of uncertainty, then a carbon tax is the preferred policy instrument. So I think, one of the consequences of the way in which the IPCC has conducted itself, certainly over the past couple of assessment reports, is that it's tended to push people down the path towards the wrong policy response. Mm. So leaving aside whether or not we should be taking action, if we accept that we should be taking action, we probably shouldn't be thinking in terms of cap and trade. We should be thinking in terms of carbon taxes as a way of putting tax on carbon.
Yeah, I noticed the report said that the Working Group 2 summary for policymakers contains many statements that are not supported sufficiently in the literature and that authors reported high confidence in some statements which there is little evidence. That's fairly serious problems. Do you think that the recommendations will address that?
Well, we're yet to see, I suppose, what the response should be. But if it is the case, they shouldn't go down the route of kind of glossing over this. This is something that isn't going to go away. I think there is an issue with climate change we need to address. It's one of responding to considerable uncertainty. How we respond to that depends upon us collectively and our policymakers understanding the inherent uncertainty, understanding what the nature of risks are, understanding whether a tax might be better than a cap-and-trade scheme, understanding that it may well be better to invest in adaptation rather than mitigation, and so on and so forth. So, we've got a chance collectively to get it right at this point. Whether we do, through the UN system, get it right is yet to be seen.
What do the report have to say about the IPCC's communications?
Well, it put great emphasis, I think, on the need for improving transparency and identifying who can speak on behalf of the IPCC and how the report should be communicated. To give you an example, the previous chair, Bob Watson, I can remember after the third assessment report, and I've written on this, was talking in the media about possible future warming over the next 100 years of 6.1 degrees. And that became the kind of, for a while, a kind of headline figure, all based on the assumption that if we frighten the children and horses, we'll take better action somehow than if we have a more mature assessment. Now, subsequently, an MIT group did an assessment of the probabilities underlying the various scenarios that produced the range of possible warming projections. The probability of the 6.1 outcome, they put a 1% probability to, a 0.01. So when you have, at that stage, a chair of an organisation who is really misrepresenting the nature of their own report for political effect, then you have a problem. So you really need to get it right so that the inherent uncertainties, the accurate information is conveyed, whatever that might mean. It's not the job of scientists to decide what the world's government should do. It's the job of our elected politicians and our policymakers and the bureaucrats and others to assess the scientific information that's provided, assess it skeptically and critically, make the appropriate trade-offs between whether we should be spending dollars here or dollars somewhere else.
Ainsley, what's the status of these recommendations? Do you know if the IPCC is going to accept them?
I can't say that. I mean, it's really up to the UN and the IPCC, and the IPCC, of course, is a kind of joint world meteorological organisation and United Nations Environment Programme body. So it'll be up to a little bit of wheeling and dealing within the UN system.
If they were to accept them, do you think it will make a big improvement to what the IPCC does?
I think it should do. If it's honoured and if it's seen through, implementation will be an important matter. I mean, it may well be that, you know, it pays lip service to the recommendations, but they kind of get lost in business as usual. That would be unfortunate, I think.
Okay, Ainsley Killow, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Ainsley Killow is Professor in the School of Government at the University of Tasmania, author of the book Science and Public Policy, The Virtuous Corruption of Virtual Environmental Science. He was an expert reviewer for the 2007 IPCC Fourth Assessment Report, which was called Climate Change and Key Vulnerabilities.
Up next, what can conservatives learn from reading Karl Marx?